I'm Dr. Joe Boot, founder and president of the Ezra Institute in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. And I want to invite you to the Mission of God conference in your area. Come and be equipped to think Christianly about every area of life and engage culture to the glory of God.
This week on the podcast for Cultural Reformation, I'm Pastor Nate. I'm joined by Dr. Joe Boot and Dr. Michael Thiessen, and we're here today to talk about the astonishing results of the U.S. election. Well, welcome back to all our listeners. This is the podcast for Cultural Reformation brought to you by the Ezra Institute, where we engage culture with the claims of Christ and equip current and emerging cultural leaders with biblical worldview, Christian philosophy, and cultural apologetic studies through print and digital resources, conferences, and training programs. Obviously, you're listening to this podcast, which is one of our digital resources. And just as we get into the show today, I would invite all of our listeners, there are many of you who still listen, who haven't subscribed or hit the bell for the notification. So if you want to stay up to date on all that's happening and all of our resources, please do subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. It helps us greatly to continue to get Ezra resources out there. And as we come to the end of the year, I would also invite you to just consider partnering with the Ezra Institute financially. We'll put a QR code up on this if you're watching on YouTube where you can go and donate, but we would love to partner with you so that we can continue to expand the reach of the Institute. As I said, today I'm joined by Dr. Joe Boot, Dr. Michael Thiessen, and we are all thrilled to be able to talk about the great news coming out of the U.S. election. There's lots of good things for us to talk about, but before we get into them, Joe, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, Nate. Just back from a trip to Germany and an important conference there and a great time there, and getting myself prepared for our Mission of God conferences in Canada coming up. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, for those of you who aren't aware, we do have two conferences, one at West and one in Ontario coming up, Mission of God Conference, Think Christianly, where we'll be talking about how to think like a Christian in various spheres of life. We have one in Windsor at Harvest Windsor. We also have a Mission of God Conference coming up in Denver, Colorado, and we're excited about that. You can find all of that stuff on our website. I don't want to forget about you, Michael. How are you today? You have a big grin on your face, ear to ear, down in Kentucky after the results of the election. How are you, my friend?
It's a good day to be alive. what an exciting week. Just in last night, of course, we knew that Donald Trump had won the presidential race. We knew that Republicans had also won the Senate race. And just in overnight, we have now got reports coming in from, we've got the decision desk reporting that the Republicans are at 219 seats, and that means they needed 218 for the majority. And so they're over the line there with at least two more states potentially where they're in the lead. So the results, the feeling all across the United States has been from Christians, and I think it's very appropriate, is the Lord has been gracious, and this is far more than a political victory. You know, last week we really got into how culture affects elections and affects people and their different mindsets. You know, the reality of it is the Republicans focused on election integrity. The Republican Party really went out to observe elections. And so this is seen as a win, not just in some political strategy, but the people have finally seen evil and they've decided to respond. And that response has, you know, been a significant mandate to say, let's return to constitutional values. So this is a cultural win. This is a political win. This is a legal win. It's really exciting being here on the ground. And the vast majority of Christians, like I just said, they're all just giving thanks to God and recognizing that this truly is a mercy from God.
Yeah, it's definitely exciting. I think the results of the election exceeded many of our expectations. I think there was an optimism, certainly, but in terms of seeing all three branches of government come back into the Republican control is something that many people weren't expecting. Joe, you made a comment last week, and I thought this might be a good place for us to start our conversation here, is you talked about if Trump were to win, that it would essentially be God applying the brakes to the deviancy and the degradation of society that we've been seeing. So why don't we maybe start there and just talk about the opportunity that's before Christians?
Well, a couple of initial thoughts there. First of all, I think that as Michael's referred to the Christian community in the US, we mustn't underestimate the power of prayer. The reality is, I remember one of the things that William Wilberforce said back in the 19th century about his hopes for England, and it was at the beginning of an amazing period, actually, for Great Britain at the beginning of the 19th century. He said that his hopes for Britain were not so much in her armies or her navies, her wealth, her global power, or anything like that, but in the fact that he said that there is still a remnant of people who pray, who are actually God's people in the land. He said, my hopes, he said, ultimately rest there. And I think in terms of this pause, this reprieve, that we can certainly say that's what we've got as of now, is the in America, the radical progressive trajectory politically has just been halted. And now the question is, what is going to be done with it? Right, that becomes the real question. And so it'll be interesting to talk about, Michael's just given us some first hints there at the nature of some of these results. And I think it will be helpful for actually our listeners, especially in Canada and the United Kingdom and other parts of the world who aren't as familiar with US politics, to talk about some of that. And this whole series on Christianity and politics, of course, was that we've been doing, looking at different political philosophies, was timed so that we could talk about those issues and know that in the middle of that or towards the end of that series, we would be dealing with and talking about the outcome of a US election, not knowing which way it would go. And so the challenge as it sort of stands before America right now, politically, socially, culturally, now that the electorate has well and truly pushed the brake on the radical progressive agenda, is to not make the mistakes that previous Republican administrations have done, previous conservative governments in Canada, conservative governments in Britain, have all typically made exactly the same mistake. And that is that there has been over the last 60, 70 years or so, a perpetual drag to the left. Culture and politics being dragged always leftward. And when a conservative or Republican a candidate has managed to get into power, or in Canada, a conservative party has been in government, and same in England, the opportunity has not really been taken to actually roll back or wind back many of the things that have been done. It's only a pause. And what tends to happen is the trajectory is stopped for a season, and it's halted, but it's not reversed. And I think you can look back largely over the last 40 or 50 years and see that that's been, with rare exceptions, except in my childhood with Reagan and Thatcher, that there has been a halting, but not really a moving back in the right direction, in the correct direction, in a more biblical direction. And so what's happened with this pause is an opportunity has been presented itself politically, and because politically this can mean greater freedom for the individual, greater freedom for churches, greater freedom in business, greater freedom in a whole number of different areas. There is an opportunity here to really roll back, to move back some of that tide in the culture. We ought to talk a bit about the interplay between culture and politics. Politics is an aspect of culture, of course, but we should talk about that, because an electoral decision doesn't alter culture, worldview, and ideology in and of itself. But the hope here for Christians, certainly for praying Christians, is that this will not simply be a pause. This won't simply be a four-year hiatus to the radical progressive drift, but that actually it will be an opportunity to take concrete and meaningful steps that will provide a framework, a future framework for meaningful cultural transformation. And that some of the stuff that has gone on, some of the awful things that have happened, won't just get momentarily paused for a few years, but they will actually be walked back. And so I think that those are the two things that strike me immediately as we come out of our sort of pensive podcast last week of wondering which way things were going to go. I think there is a praying people in America. There is a church in America that has prayed about this seriously for a long time, this election and its importance. God has been gracious and merciful. I think every Christian should be thankful for the fact that Kamala Harris was soundly defeated in this last election, given the policy platform of the Democrats and their agenda. And now we have to pray and work so that it isn't just a hiatus, but a meaningful turning point. And that we can't presume on that, but that's probably would be my opening thought as we get into our discussion today.
Yeah, so I want to get there. I do want to talk about how does culture get transformed. Politics, as you said, is an aspect of it. We want to give just some practical advice for where Christians go from here. What do we do coming out of election results like this? But before we get there, Michael, I know you're kind of chomping at the bit to talk a little bit about why don't you, as our Ezra guy on the ground in the U.S., just for some of our UK and Canadian listeners, what does it mean that that the Republicans won the presidency, the Senate, and the House? And maybe talk a little bit about some of the appointments that Trump has already made or is alluding to that are going to be helpful for the Christian cause in America.
Yeah, and so Nate, this conversation goes as a direct response to what Joe just said. So Joe just said one of the errors is that conservatives get in and then they don't push or they don't fulfill the mandates. What's really exciting about this, and guys, I refuse to be negative. I am not going to today in any way say that we are not going to go into a 100-year renaissance in the United States. Like we are moving. And the reason for that is we're seeing exactly what Joe was talking about in a positive sense. Trump is going in and he is letting the world know I'm on my way. So he's appointed Susie Wiles as the House Chief of Staff. She's a very well-respected individual who helped him win both of the elections. When you go to Defense Secretary, he's really making a choice between two different individuals there that are both, you know, one's from Texas and one's from Iowa. He's looking at Mike Pompeo as the director for the CIA. I don't know if you guys remember way back during COVID, it was Mike Pompeo that was the first one to say this is a leak from the lab. He said that within months of what was going on. So Mike Pompeo is a really trustworthy guy. When we get to the border czar, he has just announced that he's hiring the former director of ICE to be the border czar. And so, like, the attitude on the ground is that not only is did Trump win, but now Trump, within the 6 days, within the 5 days of having a decisive win, he is already signaling, I am going to push. And that's exactly what we need. To Joe's point, it's a really optimistic attitude here, because Trump is saying, in every way that we can see, at every measure, you know, he's appointing individuals to the financial sector that are going to be focused on deregulation. Like, everybody is looking around going, the economy is ready to explode. We're going to seriously deal with the illegal immigrants. The rule of law is going to come back into the nation. Like, he's even talked about, he released a video last week where Trump even said that if you were in a state and the attorney general of that state had stopped prosecuting against petty criminals, like, you know, theft up to $1,000, if the attorney general in that state had stopped prosecuting and that led to your store being robbed, they're even considering people being able to go back at the attorney general for compensation. Like, it's a really positive turn of events. And I think that the push that Joe was just talking about is so important. We've all been praying for it, and we continue to pray for it. It's a really exciting time.
It's interesting in sort of the providence of God and the sovereignty of God. I think had Trump won in 2020, and we can talk a little bit, you alluded to, election integrity, Michael. And the big question is, where did 15 million Democratic votes go? As we think about Trump's loss in 2020 and this resounding win in 2024, I think if Trump wins in 2020, he doesn't push as hard as he's going to now. Right, here we are after a very questionable election last time around. You have failed indictment attempts to try to make it so that Donald Trump couldn't run. You have several assassination attempts that were unsuccessful. And I think
another one was just announced yesterday that Iran has been active in yet another one. Sorry, go ahead, Nate.
Oh yeah, I wasn't even aware of that. And so I think if all of that doesn't happen, if Trump doesn't lose in 2020 and all of those things don't take place, I don't think Trump goes as scorched earth as it seems like he's going to now in terms of clearing house and cleaning up the swamp that he talked about in his first run in terms of the CIA and the FBI and all the stuff, that the really disturbing deep state stuff of unelected officials who have far too much power in the US. So I'm with you. I'm actually really optimistic that, you know, and what a kindness of God to essentially not allow Trump to win in 2020 to get Trump to the place where he is now. And one of the things I just want to talk about this, I know this isn't maybe as intellectual as Ezra podcasts sometimes are, but can we, like, Elon Musk coming in and promising to trim like 80% of the federal government is really exciting. Like, he trimmed 90% of Twitter, and Twitter seems to work just fine. So I don't know how accurate that's actually going to be, but if Elon Musk is really able to be empowered by Donald Trump to trim the federal government, I think that could have a massive ripple effect in all of the Western countries.
They're even talking about removing a number of the significant government offices out of Washington. They're actually talking about decentralizing the government so that it's not all sitting in the swamp of Washington. I know that makes you really excited, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the big hopes for this season will be that the size of the state is reduced. I mean, from our perspective, you know, we've talked about this obviously a lot at Ezra. We talk about the principle of sphere sovereignty and the centrality of that from a Christian standpoint. What we don't want to see is merely an approach and a view of the state that reflects the radical left, the Marxist left, but just with a more conservative economic or social platform attached to it. We want to see the size of the state reduced. That should be a clear priority for any Christian thinking about political life, is localism and the rejection of statism, where the state is pushed out of multiple areas of life that it thinks it belongs. And so an agenda of deregulation, an agenda of localism, an agenda of cutting the size of the state drastically, as you say, whether Elon has the influence to begin to shape some of that. But I would have said any substantial reduction in the size of the state, of Washington, of the bureaucracy. Don't forget that in the history of the US and, of course, of Canada and of the United Kingdom, politics was not a full-time occupation for people. You showed up a few weeks of the year for Congress. There was, you know, life was about freedom, and civil government was one of many governments in the life of people. And the reason that, you know, our states are in trillions of pounds and dollars worth of debt in the West is because of the size of the state and what the state presumes to want to provide and supply for people. Everything from medical care to child care to cradle to grave security, education, the list goes on and on and on. So any move towards cutting the state largesse and the size of the state would be most welcome during this period, because obviously that is a fundamental for freedom under God. You can't have freedom under God if the state has taken the place of God. So a commitment to reducing the size of the state will be very important. Just in terms of the election integrity and all of that, I don't know whether you guys noticed, as I did, that people may not be aware, of course, that Trump had a clean sweep of all of the swing states. So every single one of the swing states went with Trump. And if you look at the electoral map, the states where Trump didn't win are the states where ID is not required to vote, which is interesting. In the states where Trump wins, ID identification is required to actually vote. So that was an interesting thing to me, that I think there was a tightening up this time around. There was better observation, and I'm sure that people were much more active in trying to ensure dead people weren't voting, and large ballot drops at mysterious times of the night weren't happening as well. And obviously, you know, the significance, the size of the majority. So he's got the popular vote, and not just the college votes, which is hugely significant. And don't forget, again, for those who are not in America and aren't as familiar with American politics, you know, just getting a president into the White House is not often that significant in U.S. politics if you don't control the Senate and you don't control the House of Representatives. If you don't have Congress and the Senate, a president can be in office for 4 years and have his hands entirely tied, and find that they can't put a legislative agenda through. They can't bring about meaningful change. Things get simply endlessly held up in the two houses. And so to have won Congress, because that speaks, don't forget, of localism, to have won Congress and to have won the Senate, again, for those who don't fully know or understand what goes on with the way the Americans vote, you can vote for your congressman and your senator and your local congressman, and you make a separate vote you can make a distinct vote for the president. So, you know, the fact that the Republicans now control the Congress and the Senate, as well as having the White House, means that there is maybe a once in a generation opportunity here to actually bring about meaningful change in these core issues that we're talking about. And so in a sense, there's no excuses, is there, this time around? No excuses for not seeing meaningful change, a meaningful rollback of the radical agenda that's been pushed through really since the Obama years.
So let me ask one question that might seem sort of out of left field from this conversation, but I think it's worth Christians thinking through, especially as Ezra Institute, we try to help people think biblically, think Christianly. And obviously we take a great deal of care in how we handle God's law. And so one of the major things that I think was a part of this election was immigration, right? Trump's promise to stop the unfettered immigration, to close the borders, and to deal with the illegal immigrants. And so let's just talk a little bit about, and maybe Joe, you can start, and then Michael, you can kind of mop up some of those thoughts. But now you have a whole lot of people who voted for Trump who are looking around and knowing that their country has been absolutely flooded with illegal immigrants. What's the biblical approach to exporting immigrants in a way that is kind and biblical? What is it that Christians ought to be calling for now for the federal government to do to solve the problem that's so profound throughout the United States? What does it's one thing to say what is biblical immigration, but then the second question becomes how do you deal biblically with the flood of illegals in your country?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the flood of illegals in the West in general, which has been very pronounced on the U.S. border with Mexico, has been part of a radical agenda to try and destabilize the Christian character of the country, and of course, to as you know, I think it's probably fair to say, Michael may differ, but I think it's probably fair to say as well that it's been about the Democrats assuming that the more illegal migrants they can flood the country with, the better their hopes of long-term remaining in power in the United States, because their presumption is, well, immigrants will vote for us. So one of the things that is worth mentioning, of course, about the history of the United States is that its history is one that was first built on settlers from Britain and from Europe. So the nation was established around settlers. And then its history of being a welcoming country for migrants. I mean, that's the Statue of Liberty, you know, give me your huddled masses yearning to be free. There was a confidence in a broadly Christian world and life view in America that immigrants could be effectively and successfully integrated into an American identity. I mean, one of the differences that Canadians will know historically between the U.S. and Canada has been that the U.S. Had, you know, with a very clear understanding of, in a certain sense, a sense of calling about freedom and liberty. When you came to America, you became an American first. You were coming to the United States to be an American and to pursue. Life and freedom and the pursuit of happiness. You know, Americans talk about the American dream, which is basically a vision of freedom and the freedom to own your property without a threat and interference, and to build and develop family and wealth. And that was the American dream. And so you pledged allegiance then to the flag of the United States, and you became an American, and that was seen as a privilege and a blessing. In Canada, of course, over the last number of years, the last few decades, perhaps really since Trudeau Senior, Canada's vision was not about people coming to Canada, a country also built initially from as part of the British Commonwealth on migrants from Britain, but then from Europe, and then later again from the rest of the world, some, of course, even from the United States. As it lost its Christian identity, people coming into Canada didn't primarily see themselves as Canadian, and it formed a mosaic rather than having an integrating concept of being an American. I think, and you guys both being Canadian, will have a strong, myself living in Canada almost 20 years, you got that strong sense that Canada was a mosaic, that it was, and it prided itself on being a multicultural society in the sense that you came to Canada, but you kept your original identity. There's no real requirement of integration. You can pursue your own religious ideals. Because, you know, Canada is this place that is a pluralistic, multicultural, and, you know, it's a mosaic. And so there really was a loss of a sense of Canadian identity. In fact, I read a book a few years ago when I was still living in Canada called What is a Canadian? Question mark. Because of the steady loss of Canadian identity once that Christian identity and connection, stronger connection to the motherland was lost. So the sort of principled pluralism, which we have often said at Ezra, is polytheism. It's, you know, many gods. Now, in America, the idea was one nation under God, allegiance there. And of course, America was built around English common law through the English tradition of Alfred the Great and then Blackstone and so on. That was the foundation of American rule of law. And so the idea was you came to America, you could live in freedom under the rule of law, broadly Christian law, and within a Christian world and life view context. And Americans had a confidence that, yes, you could accept migrants, because, of course, after the settlers, America has been built purely on migration. Look at the diversity of America. It's hugely diverse, but the idea was allegiance to God and to America, and you became an American. As America started to lose with the rest of the world its confidence in its Christian character, you know, rather than going down to the docks of New York as the missionaries did and the Christians did in the early years of the United States to convert even the gangs of New York and all of these migrants coming and convert them to Christianity and integrate them into the society, when we lost that confidence, the West started to lose the ability to successfully integrate newcomers. That's been our critical problem. That's become a critical problem in the United States. Now, one of the interesting turn of events with this, Nate, and I'm not ducking the question, I'm just sort of setting up my answer. One of the interesting things is that this last election, black men and Latinos, the Latin American population, had a significant swing to the Republican Party. That actually people who have come into America lawfully, even if they're from Mexico or somewhere else in Central or South America, are not happy about what's happening to the United States with illegal immigration. They feel we came here legally. We went through all, we jumped through all of the hoops. We work hard. And all of this is being made a mockery of, really. And so there was a significant shift in this election with Latino voters and with black men towards the Republicans. And so the bottom line is you cannot have, and that reflects the fact that you actually cannot have a nation without borders. I mean, when God establishes the nation of Israel, he promises them a land. He doesn't just say, right, I've made you a nation, so you're going to wander around in the wilderness for the rest of your days. You're a nomadic nation. The reason that, you know, this will be controversial, we'll tread on some toes here, but the reason the first nations in North America are not nations is partly because they weren't nations as such. They were nomadic peoples wandering around the tundra. And so you cannot have a nation without a law order and without borders. If you don't have sovereign borders, you simply can't have a nation. Israel had borders. And so if you wanted to come and live in Israel, the wonderful thing was, and the U.S. saw itself as a city set on a hill. That was something that the early pilgrims wanted America to be. In Israel, you had to be willing to come and live under the law order of Israel. You weren't forced to go to make sacrifices at the temple, but there was to be one law for the stranger and the alien. God in Leviticus requires love for the alien and the stranger, right? So that is, they're to be treated the same under the law. Islam doesn't treat people the same under the law. Marxist law doesn't want to treat people the same under the law. It's all about affirmative action and inverse oppression, right? So equality and before the law is a biblical principle. You know, Marxists want equality of outcomes, and that means no equality before the law. But the American vision was equality before the law following scripture and within specific boundaries. So you can't have a nation and you can't have the rule of law with mass illegal migration. We're finding that out right across the West. Americans at this election just voted resoundingly to say, we want a nation with the rule of law. That requires borders. Now, that means dealing with illegal migrants. That means addressing those who have snuck into the country or hidden in the country or are dodging the courts or have absconded from their cases being looked at, all the different things that go on, clamping down on the smuggling of peoples and so forth. And sending people back. I mean, the problem in Britain is they're coming over on the boats from Europe in inflatable dinghies brought over by smuggling gangs, and they're told, throw all of your documentation, throw all of your passports, all of your paperwork overboard into the English Channel so that there's no record of where you're from, so you can't be sent back. Well, the people need to be sent back to their places of origin and told you can apply legally. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't legitimate cases of real and genuine refugees who are making an asylum claim because of religious persecution, right? And we would want in America, I would imagine, and Christians listening to this would want America to remain a place where people who are genuinely suffering under a tyrannical regime for their faith, in particular the Christian faith, I should add, that we would want to be a place of refuge. You know, there were cities of refuge in Israel. There would be a place of refuge to come to the United States and have your asylum claim heard to see if it's legitimate. And a lot of people try and position this as all, you know, the Republicans are anti all immigration. That isn't true. They're anti mass illegal migration. And in particular, the other factor is looking at where migrants are coming from. Flooding a country with people of a completely different world and life view that is hostile to the host culture. So the Islamic worldview is fundamentally hostile to the American founding and what that founding is about. That needs to be seriously looked at. So genuine asylum, genuine refugees, America, I'm sure, from a Christian standpoint, should remain open to that. And any returning of asylum seekers or migrants obviously needs to be done in a humane and kind way, as you said, Nate. We have to remember that these are human beings. And one of the charges that's leveled at conservatives often when they address the issue of illegal migration is that it's somehow inhuman and they don't care about people and so on. That simply isn't true. And people do need to be cared for in this process appropriately as image bearers of God, and fed and watered and sent back appropriately to their places of origin. If they want to come to America, then to proceed with a legal application to come into the United States. So I think, I guess I'm trying to put the broader picture there together. We want to be compassionate as Western people, and American Christians, in my experience, are compassionate people for the most part. America as a nation has been a country that's built itself around immigrants who have come in to be American. But it's about sifting through the right kind of immigrants. And who do you want? If a country loses control of who it is that's coming in and out of their country, it can no longer be a stable nation. And I think that's the starting point. This is not a lack of love or a compassion. It's about, because in the end, the moral aspect of love has to be rooted in the juridical requirements of law. You can't be loving to anybody if we don't have the rule of law.
Yeah, I think that's all really good and really important, because I think your assessment that this was an election where the American people resoundingly voted for the return of a rule of law. I think that's a really astute assessment. And I think now Christians who voted for that are going to be, as we talked about at the beginning, pushing. And in their pushing, we want them to continue to think Christianly about all these kinds of things. Michael, I don't want you to be lost in the background there. Did you have anything you wanted to add to Joe's comments?
Yeah, there's actually a really significant cultural and familial and ecclesiastical application here for us to be thinking about. So number one, all the comments that Joe made about the same rule of law for an alien and for a citizen or a native born, we get all of that from, you know, the book of Exodus. We have two different tiers of laws in there, as Joe said. An alien was not compelled to sacrifice at the temple, but if you wanted to sacrifice and celebrate the Lord's Passover, you had to have all of the males in your house circumcised, symbolizing that you were becoming under the covenant. This was a moment of faith for you. But outside of that religious act, every alien had to live under the rules that were put in place. So I think that's really important. We're given two commands in Exodus that just are repeated: don't mistreat an alien or oppress him. But then the exact opposite is stated many times. If an alien or native born does these things, it is the same law, one law. So that's really good to preface why it's important that you can't just say to illegal immigrants, do whatever you want, because you might be a really great sympathetic video, right? Like this is what the Dems are going to do for the next 4 years. They're just going to take pictures of little kids, you know, crying because their parents have to get onto an airplane. And they have to get onto an airplane with their parents. It's a sympathetic plea, but it does not promote the rule of law. And American citizens are tired of it. You actually see the former director of ICE in defending some of his policies saying, hey, look, like if I as an American am charged with drunk driving, you know, and there's a child in the car with me, we get separated for a time until the legal system works itself out. And so, of course, there's no desire to actually separate parents with young children and all of those things. You need to bring family units together. But in Scripture, we really actually do have quite a precedent for expelling. And this is where I think you guys are going to have some fun with commenting about this. So, of course, we have in the book of 1 Samuel and in 1 Kings examples of Saul expelling citizens who were involved in illegal practices like mediation and spiritism. He expelled male shrine prostitutes. And then this goes into the New Testament, where we as the body of Christ are supposed to expel the immoral man from our presence. So think about this, what's going on culturally within the church and then within the nation. If you will not deal with sin at a family level, then the most abusive child just abuses the whole family. If you will not deal with sin at the church level, then the most sinful person in the church dictates the agenda of the church. And if you will not deal with illegal behavior in your nation, you then cave into a mob of criminals. So this is why this is really important. I think obviously the gracious way to do this is certainly for care. So Americans should not be walking around looking at every Mexican that they see and saying illegal. There actually has to be a due process. And so people need to be careful about that. I think we need to start with criminals. Every person here who is identifiably a criminal needs to be just out and gone immediately as fast as possible. And then you just keep working at it and you don't give into the sentimentalism. If you want to come back, and Joe, you mentioned this at the end of your comments, Trump has already said this. Like they want legal immigrants in this country in order to deal with a booming economy that they're expecting. So Trump has even said like the phrase, I can't remember how he said it, but like, we might have to bring a bunch of them back in, but they've got to come in legally. Like there's this already this willingness to participate with people who want to immigrate legally. So yeah, I think that this is a really important cultural moment to not give away. Like what the Democrats were doing was extortion. And then what they were doing to the people they were bringing in illegally was a form of bribery. If you come, then, and this plays out in the family and in the church and in the nation. And I think it's a really important moment to be decisive saying, we uphold the rule of law in all of those areas of government.
Yeah, I think this point about the criminals, Michael, and exile, you do make a good point there that this was part of biblical law too. And if it was the case that you as an Israelite could be exiled for criminality as a citizen, as somebody born there, as a Hebrew, right? You could be exiled from the community. How much more somebody who's not yet a citizen? So, in the Commonwealth of Israel, you talked about circumcision. Well, yeah, you could convert and become a full citizen of the Commonwealth of Israel and be circumcised and so forth. And that was the ultimate goal, of course, was that people would, remember in Deuteronomy 4, people were meant to, the goal of God's calling of the nation of Israel and giving them the boundaries that he did was so that the other nations might look at Israel and say, who has a God like this God? Who has laws like all the righteous laws that they've been given? We want to be like them. We want to model our nation on them. We want to copy their laws and the way they do things. That was the ultimate goal. And of course, Paul in Acts 17 actually tells us that the missiological purpose of the nations in God's plan anyway was so that people might reach out to God and reach out for him and find him, even though he's not far from each one of us. So God had a purpose in the nations. If it was true, even for the Israelite, that if you committed crimes, you could be exiled, it's thoroughly biblical that non-citizens who commit crimes, starting with criminals, that seems to be absolutely obvious. We've had some absolutely horrendous cases in this country where we haven't been able to get rid of murderers and rapists and even terrorists out of Britain because of something called the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, because every time we try and get rid of some of these people, some lawyer, lefty lawyer, brings a case to the European Court and the plane is halted and prevented from taking off. I mean, what kind of a situation are you in as a nation where you can't even get rid of non-citizen criminals? And so this is why there's a move now in this country politically to withdraw from the European Court of Human Rights. And actually, some of the refugee conventions as well that were built specifically for the post-World War II problem of some of these international treaties on refugees were specifically designed to deal with the fallout of World War II. Entire countries had been destroyed, cities completely leveled. And so obviously, it was a massive displacement crisis. So conventions and treaties were signed. Many of these are no longer fit for purpose. They don't fit the modern situation. They were a measure that was taken to deal with a particular situation after the war. So this is part of the rule of law, as you say, that exile is a biblical principle, especially when you're dealing with criminals. And actually, from a just from a legal standpoint, people who have entered illegally and have total disregard for the law of the country have committed a criminal act.
Yeah.
Well, Nate, you should really keep talking about this, but just to that point, Joe, like, I'm a legal immigrant in the United States. If Kamala had have won and the borders had have opened up, what does every legal immigrant do? Like, I'm doing all of this work for absolutely nothing. It's absolutely meaningless. So, yeah. What do you think, Nate? What do you got?
Yeah, I think your comments around individuals being held hostage, whether it's a family being held hostage by the lawlessness of a child or a wife or a husband, same thing in the church. I'm just thinking through what we often talk about as a pastor and as a father. We often talk about that the working out of theonomy happens at the individual and the local level, right? So if you want to see your church reformed and you aren't an elder or a pastor in your church, you start with the reformation at home. Begin to discipline your kids, begin to love your wife, begin to disciple your wife, you know, all of these kinds of things. Wives, begin to respect your husbands. Don't nag your husbands. Don't allow your emotionalism to rule your house. So you bring these things to bear locally first. And so that's maybe a place, as we're getting on in time here, where I think it would be really helpful for us to kind of talk about localism and how we can actually begin to see, you know, in this great time of mercy that the Lord has given to the church has an opportunity now to push, as we said at the beginning of this podcast, and really not just, you know, take ground. We want to see the church take ground. So my point in all of that is to say, you know, how is it that we can begin to act locally in a way that we see this period, these next 4 years that we have or so, as a time of pushing forward the agenda of Christ in America. So talk a little bit about localism. Maybe I'll let Michael speak first, and then I'll let Joe drop the mic as we wrap our time up together.
Drop the mic, no pun intended.
Always a good move.
No, I think that just, I'll be very brief on this. Local churches have seen the mercy of God. They've seen that they are now living under the leadership, like the shield of a government that is mandated. So now, locally, every single time the left criticizes or pushes, they have to overcome their fear of man and speak the truth of God. And so there's no more excuse, as Joe said at the beginning of the podcast. And that is the responsibility of believers. Oh, they're deporting illegals. Yes, because we believe in the rule of law. And so I think that's the most pressing issue, is that Christians need to not, you know, sometimes when you're behind the guy who's at the front lines and he's got the shield and he's taking all the hits, you know, someone looks at you and you can go, yeah, the guy, he's really intense. Like, yeah. No, we need to get behind this mandate and teach culturally at a local level, just in the conversations that we have. Don't give an inch. Even as we're talking about the deportation and compassion, yes, we're going to be thinking about compassion. Don't get lost in the false accusation that it's, that there's a lack of compassion in the United States. It's not true. Don't give an inch.
Joe, what do you think about how Christians can act locally in this time of opportunity?
Well, as Michael pointed out, the opportunity, as you say right now, is that we've got an incoming civil government that is not hostile to the Christian faith and the Christian church. None of us would pretend that John Calvin has just been made the president, or William Wilberforce has just been elected to the Oval Office. That's not what this podcast is about. We're not pretending that. We're not making any concrete claims about the personal heart condition of Donald Trump. We recognize, as we talked about last week, that, you know, we are dealing with fallible human beings always in political life. In this case, we're not dealing with a man who has an impeccable Christian track record. Let's face it. We can be perfectly honest about that. But what we are, I know that's an understatement, but what we are dealing with is a man who was the first president, to my knowledge, to ever attend a pro-life rally in a major city in America, was the president whose Supreme Court picks produced what was almost unthinkable to Americans even a few years ago, and that would have been the rolling back of Roe v. Wade to a localism, really, to the states, right? So that the people of a given state could address that issue locally. And that's given opportunity to pro-life groups who believe in the abolition of abortion to start taking bills at the local level. So there's one illustration of the localism we're talking about. So Michael's talked about, or you mentioned, Nate, as well, the family, how we begin to apply God's word in our families. And so this election, as it stands today, has put into power a Congress and a Senate and a president that are not hostile to the Christian faith. They're not going to stop, try and prevent Christian people representing Christian values in the public space. And that's what we were up against with the previous administration. There was a concerted effort in fact, there was a moment, I don't know whether you saw this, but during the one of Kamala Harris's rallies, somebody in the audience, when she was talking about abortion rights, shouted out, "Jesus is king," and talked about the lie of abortion. And she said, "You're at the wrong rally. You should be at the smaller one down the road. We don't want your kind here." There was just like Trudeau, if you remember, where the last previous election made it crystal clear that no pro-life candidate was welcome in the Liberal Party.
Yeah.
So that that's just one issue. But if you look across all the issues, you know, gender, identity, size of the state, levels of debt, international foreign policy, immigration, all of these different issues, you could go down the list, and you could find policies that were fundamentally hostile to a Christian world and life view.
I'm now, literally being triggered. Joe just went through the list, and I'm literally being triggered.
So we've now got a government in place in the state, or we'll have from January, that is not taken an openly hostile stance on these issues, but actually is concerned with making room and providing freedom and liberty to the Christian perspective, and that provides this. It's that actually provides this local opportunity. And as I said earlier, you know, what we shouldn't be thinking is, oh, right, now we can sit back, now we can relax, because now we've got a Republican. We control all three parts of the government in a Republican context now at civil government level. Now we can relax and sit back and let the state get on with it. That's the opposite of what we would be saying. It's now we have this opportunity. Use the liberty now that is going to be presented to us, the new areas of freedom, to obviously be as Christians, to always be in prayer, and then to act at the family level, at the ecclesiastical level, at the social level, and at the civic level, that in every area of engagement, we get involved. One of the greatest failures of the last, you know, 60, 70 years, and we've talked about it at Ezra a lot, of the Christian church has been its almost total disengagement from the socio-cultural and political issues of our time. We've disengaged, and we've allowed the whole life of the nation to be run by hostile worldviews and perspectives, as we've pietized in a quietist and retreatist mentality to the space between our ears. So the opportunity now is to say, no, we're going to, at every level, get involved educationally, get involved at the civic level, get involved in so presenting bills, running for public office, having the church speak out clearly and faithfully, being faithful in our families, in our marriages, teaching our children, home education, Christian schools, building Christian faithful Christian businesses, engaging at every single level. You know, one of the things that kind of amused me just a few days after the election was this new movement that's come up in the States. Of course, there was a lot of liberal tears the last a few days, as you know. And one of them was this group that apparently have got their movement out of Korea. Yeah, and it's about basically liberal women saying that, saying that they are. I think it was something like BM4 or MB4, something like that movement. And basically, it was saying we are no longer going to sleep with men. We are not going to get married and have children. We are, you know, we're basically radical feminism. We are going to boycott men. Period. And I thought, this is wonderful, because now we have a tremendous opportunity to encourage Christian marriage and building faithful Christian families and Christians having lots of children, because as we said before, that worldview that is opposing us is a death cult. It's a religion of sterility. I mean, that proves it. It's an anti-family, anti-child, anti-God, anti-marriage movement. And I say, let them get on with that. And so at the most basic level, you know, encouraging young men to be faithful Christian men, to commit themselves to marriage, build families. This is a tremendous opportunity, I think, that we have. I've got one last point to make, and then I'll throw it back to you guys to have the last word. And that is to say that we've often talked on our program about the interrelation between politics and culture, and the fact that politics, yes, is an element of culture, but it's not the source of the river, it's the mouth of the river. And we've just seen that at this election, right? The reason now that this space is opening up is because at the cultural level, people were getting fed up, they were getting sick to the back teeth, and so they voted with their feet at the election and said, no more of that. They haven't just all come forward at a Billy Graham crusade. Let's remember that too, right? What they did is they said, we're going in the wrong direction. Something's gone badly wrong. They're not even sure, all of them, what's gone wrong. Many of them have no idea really what's gone wrong. They just know that they don't like what they see. And that's what gives us this crucial opportunity. It's culture in the end that forms and shapes politics. If the electorate at this last US election had been on board with the LGBTQ movement, with Marxist economics and politics and everything else, they would have just put Kamala Harris into power, right? If they'd felt that was the right direction. They didn't feel that was the right direction. So now there is an opportunity at the cultural level now to continue to pray and to work and to serve, so that the culture will form and shape politics. In the end, politicians want to be in power. They want to be elected. And so they're elected to represent us. Remember, it's the House of Representatives. They represent us, not themselves. They're supposed to represent us for the Americans, just like MPs in Canada and the United Kingdom are supposed to represent us. We elect them at the local level so that they represent us. And so this is the opportunity, I think, to reduce politics, to reduce civil government to its appropriate size. That's what localism does. When people once again take charge of their lives under God as individuals, families, churches, businesses, schools, and so on, then Caesar gets smaller. If you want Caesar to get smaller, Christ has to get bigger in every aspect of our lives. And so that, to me, seems to be the key. And let me finish with this verse from, and throw it back to you guys for comment, from Psalm 146, because the danger is people rest on their laurels again and they say, we can breathe a sigh of relief. The radical progressives are out of office. And now all shall be well. No, that would be absolutely the wrong step. What does Psalm 146 say? Do not trust in nobles or princes, in man who cannot save. When his breath leaves him, he returns to the ground. On that day, his plans die. Happy is the one whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord, his God, the maker of heaven and earth. He's the one, the psalmist says, who remains faithful forever. So don't put your hope in princes and nobles, in presidents, in congressmen, in senators, and so on. We put our hope in Christ, and we call upon presidents and congressmen and senators and MPs and prime ministers and so forth. We call upon them to serve the Lord. We prophetically propose from the word of God as his people what they should now be doing in government. We do not put our trust in nobles and princes in whom there is no help. The day that they die or leave office, all their plans, they're gone, right? Their hopes and dreams are gone. That's man in his vanity. And the nations to the Lord are as a drop in the bucket. Our hope is in God. And so we call now these leaders who have been elected to account in terms of the word of God. And we seek to encourage them to honor Christ and his word in all that they do. And that's the opportunity that we now have. And it's a very, very exciting one.
Before you close us down, Nate, which I know you're just dying to do, I want to make one point. Joe Boot just said that this is how we see politics reduced. And I want everybody who's listening to understand this. When we think Christianly about politics and it gets into its rightful place, then you actually see a reduction of politics in the life of the church and the individual. So every person who goes out and accuses the Ezra Institute of saying, you know, you're making the gospel political or you're too political. No, it is that they're being non-political, they're being non-Christian in their views, they're falsely accusing individuals who are trying to think biblically and critically through the issues, and then they, by default, make politics about everything. And so even in that last little clip that Joe was saying, it's very important to listen. A Christian mind talks about politics, but a Christian mind helps politics be controlled and reduced. And I thought that was such an important statement. I didn't want our listeners to just skate over that. We do talk about politics, but it's so that it gets put in its rightful spot. And, you know, literally take that little clip of Joe. And anytime someone says the Ezra Institute is too political, you just take that little clip of Joe and there you go.
I think it's I think we're going to have a lot to talk about over the weeks and the months to come. I think that there's a lot of exciting things. And I think to summarize Joe's call to action there a few moments ago is the fight's not over. The fight just started. So get in the fight. And everything that Joe said doesn't have to be on the agenda of every Christian. We are gifted differently. We are called differently. But every Christian ought to take their opportunities, their vocation, their skills, their gifts, and fight within that sphere. And if we all move ahead in that direction with that spirit, then the ground that we can take is, I think, unfathomable in a lot of ways. So, as we wrap up here, what we would say is find your place in the fight and go fight. And certainly if you want to partner with the Ezra Institute, as we, look at this, window that we have as a great opportunity to fight and to take ground, we would encourage you to go to theezrainstitute.com, click on, the QR code. If you're watching this on YouTube, partner with us financially, reach out to us and partner with us by volunteering or taking up some of our training programs. There's lots going on. We're certainly ready to fight and we hope that you'll come and fight alongside us. Well, guys, that was a much more in-depth show than we thought that we would just kind of look at the election, but it never is. When you get three pastors together, we're never gonna be under 40 minutes. So,
just like Donald Trump said about Russia and the perfect call, it was the perfect podcast.
It was beautiful. All right.
It was the best podcast in all of history of all of
the most beautiful, the most awesome. Okay. before we completely go off the rails, you're getting a peek behind the curtain here, but we encourage you to keep listening, subscribe, like, and we'll see you next week. And until next week, we remind you that from him and through him and to him are all things. May God have the glory forever. Amen.